Tonight, we are fortunate to have artist Cynthia Danio here from New York. With a BA from Stanford in 2001, Cynthia moved to New York to work with and learn from artists that she admired. She has since lived and worked in New York, where she is represented by Lisa Cooley Gallery. She has made an interesting life for herself as a painter, writer, and musician, and has found success in each of those practices as they feed each other. She received a 2010 McDowell Colony Fellowship and 2011 Rima Hort Mann Foundation grant, and has published a number of articles and edited the monogram Sean Landers' Improbable History. That was in 2011. She also published two limited editions artist books, CCTV in 2012 and I Love You More Than One More Day in 2013. The latter was in conjunction with her show Which is the Sun, Which is the Shadow at Lisa Cooley Gallery. I Love You More Than One More Day is an impressive undertaking, a meditation on sky and on painting, a collection of 365 paintings taken from daily drawings that are currently, I'm happy to report, hanging suitably under the skylight in Gallery 11 in the West Corridor of the second floor of this museum. They are very much worth the time they require, and they do require time and probably a repeat visit, so I'm giving you fair warning. Of this piece, the New Yorker wrote, and I'm going to read this entire quote, "Take your time with this subtly yearning poet of a painter. Big creamy oils breed single floating images of windows or shadows or a pale sun and fields of close-toned beige and light blue strokes. 365 small paintings render one a day skies in wide-ranging styles and share the title, I Love You More Than One More Day. A restrictive lyricist sees within cautious formal constraints. The work stammers on the verge of transcendence, as if having forgotten and then just half remembering some vital thing it was about to say." That is a very long and beautiful quote. It's one of many about Cynthia's work, but I thought it was representative of the many. They often go off in this kind of poetic fashion when talking about her work. And I also was struck by how much the New Yorker editor who wrote that particular goings-on about town column, how much, which of course most of you know is a regular column for the New Yorker and different editors take turns writing it. I just couldn't get past how much that particular editor must have enjoyed writing that, finding work that allowed him or her to feel so much. I'm sure that's not always the case for the going-ons about town. So tonight, Cynthia's here to present what she titled Lasting Impressions Following the Footsteps of the Impressionist in Contemporary Painting, which is a title that she gave me long ago when she accepted the invitation, and a title that may not still apply, but regardless, we're in for a real treat. So please join me in welcoming Cynthia Danio.
That's funny. Terry started with that. Peter Sheldahl wrote that quote in the New Yorker, and Peter wrote me a very sweet email about it. He's an incredible writer, but I tear up when I hear it, so I'm going to regather myself right now. First off, I just want to say thank you to The Modern for inviting me. This is a real gift and honor for me to be here, and I want to thank Terry, and thank all of you for coming. Hopefully, we'll have an enjoyable and perhaps informative, or informative and perhaps enjoyable evening. Let's hope both. A few things, I guess. I am also very honored to have this piece pictured here, which, if you haven't seen it yet, is the aforementioned piece that Terry spoke of, which is installed upstairs. And it seemed, because the piece is here at the museum, that it would be a great piece to talk about, and to talk a little bit about that piece and the show that it came from, which was my most recent solo show at the Lisa Cooley Gallery in New York this fall, in October and November. So, okay. This is the piece here. The piece was in, this is kind of an install shot of the gallery. The piece was installed in the back room along four walls, so it was an installation. And in the front, there was a series of paintings, large scale, about 7 feet, that were more abstract of shadow and light, which I will return to a little bit. And as far as this piece goes that Terry spoke about, I made the piece over a year's time. As Terry alluded to, I did drawings every day, one drawing per day. And at the end of, towards the end of the year, I painted the piece. I felt strongly, I had an idea for the piece. I knew that the piece would be paintings, would be this installation immersive room like this. And from the outset, I really didn't want to paint one a day. I really wanted to paint them all at one time as much as possible. And I think the reason being that, as you can imagine from things in your own life, like, you know, playing tennis or going to the gym, at the beginning of the day or doing one thing when you start up, you're kind of in warm-up mode. And if I felt that if I had done one painting a day, it would be sort of that warm-up mode. I would do something fairly safe. I would sort of, you know, do the one per day, and it would never really be a transformative or exhaustive or cathartic exercise. It would really just be more about a practice or the discipline of doing the practice every day. And I felt strongly that I wanted it to be a piece that could be as much about endurance and the kind of catharsis that would happen if I painted all day, every day for about 3 months. So for about 3 months at the end, I painted throughout the whole day. And I would do about 8 a day, which might take 8 hours, and sometimes it took maybe 12 or 13 hours. And reason being that, as you can imagine, you go through a kind of arc where at the start of the day, I felt very fresh and fairly safe. In the middle of the day, I was like Velasquez, you know, I was an amazing painter and very facile. And by the end of the day, you are grumpy and erratic and tired. And I felt that that's where real like epiphanal change happened. Because I would take risks and do things in painting that I had never done, and because I would become so exhausted that your internal critic, the one who's painting with you, she was totally gone, and you're just trying to, like, it becomes very physical or primal or animalistic. And those paintings were the ones that were most disastrous or most triumphant, and in every case, they're the best. You know, those sort of ones at the end. And that arc was very true of the 3 months, that I started out fairly safe, and by the end, the last, like, 50 were a real emotional challenge to get through. But I wanted that to be part of the work. So it was a very personal piece for me to make. The piece was conceived at the start of the year. Someone close to me went away, and, you know, like, gone away. And I was really reflecting on that nature of absence and the nature of sort of the paradox between absence and presence when it comes to a personal relationship. There is a contradiction where someone can leave, let's say they die, move away, you know, leave you, divorce, etc. There's a way that people can leave but still be completely present. Whether they leave for life or whether they leave just for the day, the idea of how someone is with us, it's not just that they're with us in body. There's also a way that we carry people with us in our spirit or in our heart or conceptually in our mind. And I was reading Joan Didion's book, A Year of Magical Thinking. And the book, it's a great book if you've never read it. It's one of the best contemporary reflections on the nature of death and our coping with death. But her husband, her longtime husband and partner, passes away, and she writes about the year, in chronological as a year, writes about this journey through her first year of his passing, after his passing, and how she lived in this magical realist state where he was still alive, where she kept him alive. And it really meditates on the nature of who people are for us conceptually. And so even when we are distant from people, we're with them. We're both under the same sky. We're contextually with the people that we love or think about. And I was meditating on that, and this is the form that it took, basically, and this is the project that came out of it. And I think also in it was a second sort of contradiction or paradox, which is about the sky itself, which is infinite. There's an infinitude to the sky, which is this endless circle around the earth with the nonstop churning of atmosphere. And beneath it, you know, we mark time by the sky, the day that goes by. It's eternal. Literally every human that's ever existed on earth has looked up at the same sky that we look up to. Yet that is in contradiction to the finitude of our life below it, which is each day is finite, and metaphorically our life below it is finite. So I liked both that this piece represents that, the sort of endlessness and expanse that we feel beneath the sky, where we can send ourselves into the future, into the past, into space, across the earth to someone we're missing. But that also the piece marks the transition of a year and suggests the finitude of our life below it, or relative to other people. So I think I could talk all night about what I think the piece is about, or what prompted me to make it, or, you know, those various things. However, I do find that, like, there's a way that when an artist talks about what they think the piece is, it sort of shuts down learning, present or future. Those things are self-evident, and those are the things that are in the piece, and those are the things that the viewer or you are meant to experience within the piece, and I don't really think that anyone needs me lecturing about them, because that's what I put into the piece. Nor do I think my ideas about what the piece is about are more important than someone else's. I made the piece, I have my own ideas what it's about, but someone else's, your view about what you feel within it or in front of it, is equally valid to me and no more privy than my own. So, and because I don't want to talk about myself for an hour, I do want to use some of this time to talk about other work, because I think it can be equally elucidating to listen to an artist talk about work that they engage with that I think is related to this. So as a starting point, my timer is making noise. As a starting point, I want to talk about some of the artists that relate to the modern, and then maybe like move back from there, because the modern, as you know, has a preeminent collection. And I will say two things. One, which is almost all the slides I'm showing, with a few exceptions, are work that's here in Dallas that is on view currently. So I would encourage you, if you are excited by something that you see, to go see it either here at the Kimball or at the DMA. And I will also say, as a note of warning, that I am not an art historian by trade, only kind of a hackneyed hobbyist. So there may be art historians in the room, so go easy on me. Okay, so obviously Ankhuwara is one. This, I'll start with some of the work that I thought about making the piece very briefly. And one of the things I thought about was Ankhuwara, and who, as you may know, made a series of paintings every day, or most days, not every day, but over, has continued the project over his life, where there's a painting of the date on the front, and on the back is like the newspaper clipping from that day. And I really, you know, when I was making the piece, I loved the idea about, this piece touches on the idea of painting as a commemorative, as this time capsule, or the role of painting in commemoration and in memorialization and in memory. But I didn't ever feel like in Ankhuwara's work that the aggregate group really expanded beyond about what each of those days was. I really wanted a more holistic experience with the project, or with the work, that I felt like was an in where I could think about or draw a difference. The Beckers are up right now, and the idea of the indexical and the idea of this grid, which these are typologies, right? These are all pictures of water towers, and these are on view now here at the Modern. These works, you know, are famous for that when you photograph all of these different water towers, it creates kind of a visual dictionary about what defining a water tower, but not linguistically the definition of a water tower is a tower that carries water, but visually can we define an object or a concept. But in these like tautology or typology of the water tower, it doesn't answer the question for me of what does the water tower mean. So I think when I thought about the piece, I didn't want it just to be, what does sky mean? Sky is the thing above us that can look all of these ways. But what is the significance of sky? What does it mean emotionally or conceptually? And I think that's a point of differentiation. Another would be Richter. Richter, who is also on view here at the Modern now. Richter has an atlas where he's collected, I think now it's like 20,000 pictures, like little pictures on these pages that he uses as the source material for his work, you know, just clipping and photographing these grids of endless pictures. So maybe one page is all skies, and maybe one page is all donuts, and maybe one page is Holocaust pictures. He has these kind of like endless sheets. And from these, Richter will take one photo out of thousands and elevate it into a painting. This is a very large-scale painting. This is a very small page of little, like, clip-outs. This is a giant painting. And here's one from the Modern, which is taken from one of these pictures. But the thing about Richter that I really, like, did not agree with was there's this way that, I mean, did not agree is a strong word, but there's a way that elevating, in taking one of the pictures and making it into the painting, Richter speaks about elevating the one image that feels the most sky-like, or this one picture that's the most transcendent or the most sublime, and that one will become the painting that's really like a transcendent, beautiful, perfect sky. So like in a page of, you know, many options, this is the sky. And there's a way in the atlas, in Richter's atlas, where it's nihilism, the actual atlas. You have pages of a donut right next to pages of Holocaust pictures right next to the sky. And it's nihilistic the way that Google image search is nihilistic. I could just Google anything right now and I would get endless things, some of which I'm looking for or not looking for, but all of which only relate in the most cursory of way. And to me, I wanted something where rather than just elevate this one that becomes the hero image, what if you painted the whole atlas, and not in a nihilism of this is a bunch of random skies, but what if you were able to make a holistic significance that this is a year and all of these are representative within that. Further, I could talk about Felix Gonzalez Torres, whose sky piece I thought a lot about. This is a stack of this one picture, and when you encounter this piece or any of Felix's stack piece, the viewer, the goer, can take one, and you are encouraged to take one home with you. And thus disseminating and sharing like the essential sky picture with all the viewers. And of course, there's Terrell, who really framed this idea of the sky as a temporal entity where you can watch the changing over time. Now, I thought about all of these works when I was making the piece, and some of them I connect to in certain ways, and some of them I differentiate from in certain ways. But I think similarly, those connections are fairly self-evident, because what I've just outlined is literally the patriarchy. These are the predecessors, or the pieces, or the artists that come directly before me, the generation or two generations in front of me. And those connections will be made by art historians and museums and curators, and you will walk from seeing my piece into seeing the Richter piece, and those connections will happen very naturally. I think what is more fun to talk about and more unexpected is going further back to a more primal, subconscious, older, and uncool place, And so I think what I really want to talk about as a way of a very long introduction is about Impressionism. Which, let's say it this way. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. Baltimore is a second city that really had no national consciousness before The Wire, and people would sort of just drive by between D.C. and New York, and, you know, on the East Coast, people could sort of make fun of things about it, or it's not a very cool place, and as a result, like many people who grew up in a second city, I'm fiercely loyal about my hometown and growing up there, and I think we all have that way that, you know, that when you have a new boyfriend or girlfriend and you really, you want to take them to your hometown because you feel like they won't really get you until they see the place you grew up, until they come to Texas and see the sky and see the color of the light and the color of the dirt and like smell a cow, you know, you're just like, you're not going to get me until you come back with me where I'm from. I feel the same way about Baltimore, and I feel the same way about Impressionism. I loved this work first as a very young person, and loved it a lot as an art student, and still to this day I'm very passionate about this period in painting. And I can tell you, if any of you have children or grandchildren, and you go to the museum with your child or grandchild and they stop to cry in front of Matisse's piano lesson for like 10 minutes, you're in big trouble, because that was like, I saw the piano lesson and I was like, oh, this is so good. You either have a weirdo or a future painter on your hand, or both, probably. But anyway, I want to talk about Impressionism for a few reasons. One, as I was saying, it's very uncool right now. There's a lot of artists my generation who were not educated as painters. They are video artists, new media artists, and I think they kind of just walk past this stuff with Impressionism with disinterest because it's traditional, because it's very popular, because they think it's non-conceptual. And all of those things I take issue with. If anyone can look at the Rouen Cathedral series, and it's so clear that the conceptual frameworks of the entire 20th century about everything we just looked at, the grid, about time, about the color of light, everything that's in Terrell, in Richter, in Ancuara, in all of these later works, lies first in the 19th century. So I think, A, it's incredibly relevant and conceptual. B, it's very cool, and I'm really into the work myself as an artist. Lastly, I think there's a lot of things I connect to it saliently contemporarily, which I will sort of, I guess, circle to. Many of you probably know one sentence history of Impressionism is Manet was probably considered the borderline. He started to be looser. He let raw canvas be like on his paintings, so he started to suggest some of the stylistic things that we'll see in Impressionism. He made this painting. There was a yearly state-sanctioned show, basically by the government, of the best work in France. They did not allow this painting to be in it because they thought it was pornographic to have a nude in a prosaic setting. A nude was very common in like a classical setting or an allegorical setting, but they found it pornographic to put a nude in the regular everyday picnic setting. They set up an alternative art fair to show it, and then that alternative art fair became, to oversimplify it, the basis of a show that happened for a number of years by a bunch of young artists who would become the Impressionists. Monet, Pizarro, I'm like having a senior moment, but yeah. So this is the first painting that was in, that gave the title to the Impressionists. This painting is called Impression Sunset, and it was Monet's painting from the first of these shows, these kind of alternative art fair. And a critic derided the painting for being unfinished and, you know, loose and impressionistic. And that hence is where the title Impressionism comes from, though it's a really great title about imprinting an impression. So I think the first thing that will organize the way that I talk about this is, I think, beyond just knowing the history of what's the background, who are the impressionists, what are we talking about, I think the thing to ask is, what are actually the aspects of impressionism that make it impressionism? And as like a visual guide to help, I sort of present these two. I think when I go through a museum into a new room at the museum, I know that the way I look at things is I walk into the museum and I walk towards the painting that I like the best, that I think is, I'm drawn to, or that I think looks really intriguing, or that is painted in a way that I'm interested in. But I think sometimes it's also a really great exercise, and I encourage you to do it, to walk into a new gallery by posing questions first to yourself. Like, what's different in this gallery, or what's happening that differentiates it from the gallery that I was in before? Because there is certainly a person or a curator at the top who is thinking about the answers to those questions and presenting them to you. So on the left is an Ang, on the right is a Monet. And I chose these because they're visually similar. But the Ang and this impression sunset were painted less than a decade apart. And on the left, this is what was very popular, and this was the style that was at that state-sanctioned show that I talked about. This is what the Impressionists are working against. That's the Academy. This is sort of the traditional view that they would break from in the years at the late 19th century. So I think the first question is just visually, like, what's different, you know? And in thinking about what makes Impressionism, there are a number of things that we talk about when we talk about Impressionism. One is the rise of the landscape, that all of a sudden you have a ton of en plein air landscape scenes and interest in the landscape. Not just interior, not just studio shots, not just like sort of classical, you know, contextless places, but actual landscapes of grass and lakes and things. A second would be very noticeable brushwork. On the right, obviously, on the left, Ang and his contemporaries eradicated all brushwork with glazing and fan brushes, the idea being that you didn't see the human hand or evidence of the human hand. Whereas, obviously, on the right, you can see the brushwork. You can imagine the artist actually making that piece, and that's evident in it. And then one of the other aspects that is that gave obviously the name to the movement is this idea of an unfinished or casual style, where there was raw canvas left, there was a kind of, you know, very, I guess, unfinished feel is the best way to describe it. Whereas obviously the Ang looks really finished. Like, he has done that painting. That painting is very done. Whereas, you know, when an Impressionist painting is done, I mean, is it done? Is it almost done? Could you add one more stroke? You know, maybe. So sort of a very clear, unfinished quality. There are other things about color and about subject matter that I could talk about, but let's focus on those three, which I think are very salient, and I will relate now back to my own work. The first is landscape. Now, I think I will kind of steal a Richter quote, a Gerhard Richter quote, for a minute. And Richter said about that piece I showed you before, which was, he painted this sort of triumphant sky over the water, over the ocean, and that is owned here by the modern. Richter said that painting sort of relates to 19th century German sublime painting, this very old school landscape painting. And Richter's quip was that there was nothing past about that style of painting, that if the conditions were the same again, you could make the same painting today.
that it was a question not of a style that was passed, but of the conditions that make you make that style. And there's nothing passed to me about what Monet and the Impressionists were doing, because the conditions feel like they're coming around again, at least to me and in a number of places in my work. The first being this idea of landscape. The Impressionists moved, one of the reasons the work features so many landscapes, people talk about, you know, that they started doing en plein air painting or outside painting because they invented tubes of paint. That's all true, but more than that, Paris built the RER railroad system at that time, and the studio space in Paris was very inadequate and very small and very expensive, and a number of the painters of the Impressionist movement, Renoir, Monet, got places outside the city on short train rides that they would go to, and they would hang out in the country and at their country home with each other, drinking absinthe and looking at the lake. And interestingly, and hence a lot of landscape scenes started popping up in their work. If you hang around the grass and nature all day long, your work starts including those subjects. Similarly to the Hudson River School in New York, and similarly to right now, New York City, where the artists have been working in studio setups for the last 40 years, is really expensive. And if you're a young artist, studio space has gotten smaller and smaller and more expensive. And the answer about what to do with that on a pragmatic way is a lot of people, a lot of contemporary, very well-known painters are moving north and are getting second spaces or studios upstate, further from the city. And it's happening in Austin, and it's happening in Chicago, and it's happening in LA. And it certainly was my case. I had to make this last show. And this is the view from my studio where I made the piece upstairs. And it was no surprise to me that all of a sudden my work started having all these immediate landscapes, because I started spending time outside the city. And the city really closes you off from the sky or the earth. And then you get back to it and you're like, oh yeah, we're people on a globe. Like, we breathe air. Like, there's this thing around us, the sky, the atmosphere. It's no coincidence. And I think, I predict, without, I think, question, that you will see the rise of landscape in the next 20 years in a way that we have not seen it for the last 40. Because artists were working in studios in Soho in New York from 1940 until about 2005. And the number of artists who've moved outside the city in New York is staggering, and that is still the center of the art world. And I predict the rise of the landscape in the same way we saw it in the end of the 19th century. And actually, interestingly, when I was going through my slides, I noticed that in all the pieces that happened before the piece I made upstairs, when I was still living in the city, I made a lot of pieces with the sky. I thought about the sky a lot. But this, I noticed just now that the sky is mediated in every piece. Like, this is these pieces actually hang facing each other. It's a projector and it's projection. They hang on opposite walls. Here, the sky is a projection. It's not a literal sky. The sky would be behind these, like, suggested cutouts of, like, a wall. Like, you know, there's a wall between you and the sky. Through a window, you know, nature is, like, on the other side of this, like, window. This is another view of that one. Again, through a window or in reflection, that you're not even, like, you know, it's behind you, but reflected. In a book, you know, as photos, or doubly mediated, I guess, or triply, photo, book, painting. This is one that's another in a monitor. In another monitor, both of these are sky paintings that preceded those ones in a monitor. And it wasn't until today, or, you know, this week putting this lecture together, that I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, it wasn't until I made that piece, until I went back to nature, that suddenly the nature was, like, right there with me, like, without mediation, and uncoincidentally. So, and this was another piece I made at the same time as I made that piece upstairs, which is just 30 views of the sun, obviously. Well, what's the detail of one of those? So, landscape, one issue. Another, the second one I mentioned was the sort of unfinished quality. And both of these paintings are in Dallas. This is a Monet, that's really nice. And the people are kind of like blobby, you know? I mean, one brushstroke could suggest a person or an umbrella. Here, the fog in this Pizarro, the fog is sort of like, the painting is mostly white. I mean, it's sort of only suggested in the most minimal of ways. And again, these slides do not do justice to the paintings, and these are just 20 minutes away. And I'll use this. This is a piece I did this year that I will under over, it's called, that I will use to illustrate a story, I guess. I'll show a detail of maybe the third one over. This is a detail of that painting, right? So I was in school, and those paintings still live, which is why I use this as an example. And a student, a young student, an undergraduate, and I had a very hardcore painting teacher, one of these old school, very gruff, makes everyone cry, you know, very rough kind of teacher. And the kind of guy who'd come over to your canvas, look at what you were doing, tell you it was no good, and grab a paintbrush and like show you what you should have done, right? And he comes over to my station, and I have a still life of flowers or, you know, fruit or something. And he looks at my brushes, and all of my brushes were a type of brush called a filbert. And a filbert is a round brush. It's not like a straight, you know, one hair. It's not a rectangle. It's a round shape, like a dog paw. And it makes a kind of stroke that's like if a dog paw kind of pawed at your painting. So he comes and looks at the brushes to take one, and he's like, what is this? They're all filberts, you know, like, why would you do this? Like, you know, and I was like, what? I really like the filbert. Like, it's a dog paw. It's like a pawing, you know? And he's like, you can't make any lines with this. You can't delineate any shapes with this. You're just going to have a huge, hazy, foggy mess. Your paintings are a foggy mess, and now I know why. It's your filberts. You have a filbert addiction. And I was determined not to cry, and I went back to my studio, and I felt a deep sense of shame. Like, oh, I have this filbert addiction. My paintings are a hazy mess, like, no good. And this explains it. And I went and I bought a bunch of, like, the flats, they call them, and rounds, the other brushes. And I took them back, and I never used them. I bought all these flats, and I never used them. And as the years, as a young artist went by, I would think of that. It was one of those things that would, like, echo in your mind. Like, if someone made fun of your hair, you'd spend the rest of your life wondering, like, what's that hair? Was that guy in third grade bright on my hair? And, you know, John Curran was really popular when I was in school. And I was like, John Curran is such a good painter. If I didn't use so many filberts, I could probably paint like John Curran. If I didn't use so much white, you know, like, I could do it. And I really felt like this inadequacy, like there was something wrong with me. Like, it was an inability. Like, John Curran's a really good painter, I'm not a very good painter. And that's something probably a lot of young artists feel. And I felt that this was an example of my, like, you know, deficiency. And I think the first lesson you learn when you start to become like a real artist, or you start to find comfort in yourself as an artist, is you have to learn to love the artist that you are, not the artist you wish you were. And I spent a lot of years, like a lot of young people, wishing to be this type of artist that I am not. I love Vermeer. I really do. Like, I love Courbet. I love Courbet more than anything. I think John Curran's a great painter. And none of those are what I am as a painter. And I think at first I always thought it was this, like I said, a deficiency. Like, I'm not very skilled. Well, John Curran's probably really skilled, or Vermeer's probably really skilled. I'm just not that good. But you start to wonder, looking at those rounds and those flats that were totally unused in my studio, I started to wonder if it wasn't willful denial. Like, am I not that kind of painter because I just can't do it? Or am I not that kind of painter because I won't do it? And I think you start to ask some very tough questions of yourself about value system and about the painter that you want to be. I want Vermeer and Courbet and John Curran to exist in this world. I don't want to be those painters. And I don't want to be the type of painter that they are. And I think it gets down to this issue of finish and the quality of a casual style and an unfinishedness. This is from that last show, and this demonstrates, I think, what I'm talking about, sort of brushy, like, no edges. But the thing about unfinished is that there's a lot of space for the viewer to project into that. Looking at those impressionist paintings, they're not really didactic paintings. Like the Ang, which tells you exactly what you should look at, there's a lot of space for you to imagine and dream as a viewer and project into that, which I really like. It's very humanist. And I think more than that, the work is not about heroism. The thing about the Ang or John Curran or Vermeer is that they're so skilled. And like I said, I'm drawn to that. It's not like I don't appreciate a true genius of technique. But the work is foremost always about how skilled the painter is. It's like, look how great I am, you know, is the first thing. You might talk about what the painting's of or the content second, but it's always first about how transcendent the skill is when you raise a human to that great level of greatness. And, you know, there are contemporaries who I won't name names, people my own age in New York, who are very good skilled technicians. And I notice every time I go to one of their shows, the first thing someone says is, oh my gosh, look at how good of a painter they are. And like, that apple looks just like an apple. It's like a photograph, you know. And I just never wanted that to be the first thing that someone said about my work. Mainly because I think when I look at that kind of work, it makes me feel small. I feel inadequate. I feel like not very good. And I wanted to begin from a position where we are equal. It's a humanist position. We're not perfect. I'm not some angel from the sky who's been given this gift from God. I'm trying to talk about things that we share in common and from a position where we can begin as equals. Talking across a table, not me at the pulpit talking down to you didactically. And I think those value systems begin in style. And if the first thing you say about something is how good it is, it's not about the ideas and the feeling that you get in front of it. And I think I'm always drawn to painters and artists who are open in that way. Milton Avery, this is a great Milton Avery from the collection here. I love Milton Avery. I love Mirandi. And actually, when I looked through this for images for this lecture, I tried to make everything from Dallas, and there's no Mirandi that I can find in Dallas. So someone work on getting a Mirandi to Dallas because they're great. Bernard is another one who I think is really humanist and humble, a really humble painter. Philip Guston, of course. And there is a beautiful Guston up today and always, and I think often here at the Modern, which I equally love. And this is a weird one, but Carol Dunham, I just saw the new hang at the Rachofsky Collection, which if you can go, you should go. Carol Dunham has never made me feel small as a painter. And I always say there are two types of artists, but when you're an artist or an art lover, in your studio, there are artists I love a lot that are not productive for me. They don't help me or my practice. And there are artists I love that are productive. And when I'm feeling really small and low about my painting looking weird, I always think of Carol Dunham. And I'm like, his paintings are so weird. You know, like, if you would think it would be very difficult to, like, you know, be someone like John Curran and, like, put that up there. But it's very easy. Like, I'm not saying making it or getting to that point where you can make it, but to stand next to it in a room and own that as your work. Carol Dunham is, like, the most fearless artist ever. That work is weird and uncomfortable and strange-looking, and when I feel bad about myself, I'm like, well, Carol Dunham gets up every morning and makes those paintings and does not censor his weirdo, his inner weirdo. Which I, you know, we all could use some of like that.
So then lastly, the thing I will, and I'll make sure to pause for questions. Good, I'm on schedule. And then lastly is the idea of brushwork, to return to our three things of landscape and an unfinished casual quality, and then third and lastly, a noticeable brushwork. This obviously is at the Kimball. It's late Monet from World War II time when he was grieving for the rest of Europe about the war. The brushwork during Impressionism became forefront, whether it's pointillist or classic Impressionist brushwork. And you see in that the introduction into painting of a kind of tempo, right? There's a rhythm here in the paintings that isn't there when the painting is a really flat, glossy surface. And I think, you know, it's no, there's a kind of like, it could be a staccato rhythm, like with a pointillist painting, or a really legato painting with something like a Sargent or a Monet that have a kind of flow to them. And, you know, it's no coincidence that Pollock's painting, Autumn Rhythm, is called Autumn Rhythm. The painting is a visual symphony of marks and durational marks. So if you think about Pollock working, and anyone who's seen the Namath videos, it's great to watch Pollock working. Films, the each brush stroke, whether it's a pointillist brush stroke or a Pollock, has a duration unto itself. 1 second, like or 3 seconds, you know, or 10 seconds. And those durational marks aggregate like sounds in a symphony. And we experience these paintings as durational. And I think the Impressionists are really, and with the visual brushwork, is really where you start to feel and think about this idea of duration in painting. And it's not a talk I'm going to give tonight, but it is a talk I have given about painting as a time-based media, which I will shorthand for you, which relies on this idea of duration. And obviously, Autumn Rhythm, and a close-up of Autumn Rhythm, which has both the long durations and staccato, maybe like early jazz, like hi-hat notes or something. So the idea of painting as time-based or durational to me lies in three ways. There are, it's the close-up obviously of Sura. There are three types of duration. One, in, to me, easily in painting. There is duration depicted, is the first. That is the duration depicted in the painting. It takes the nude descending the staircase 5 seconds to walk down the staircase. There is a duration or time depicted of maybe 5 seconds. Maybe this is quicker, a few seconds for this bird to cross the canvas. This is Swift's Futures painting. In Cubism, this is one here with Picasso. Maybe with the head turning, you know, if you think of a Cubist as representing multiple poses or moments of a figure or a conversation, that could represent a change between two frames, like a comic maybe, which implies a duration both of the movement and of the time between the movements. Or in this Magritte, they always talk about this painting as absurd or surreal, that you'd have a night scene below and a day scene above, but you could easily read that painting as a painting, a depiction of 24 hours. Of both the nature of day and night in a single scene, that this is a duration depicted of a day, right? And second, besides duration depicted in the painting, is the duration to experience the painting. This is the duration of the viewer. It takes, I don't know how fast you read, but it takes me maybe 15 seconds to read this Baldessari. And that can be a visual duration of how long it takes your eye to move across the canvas. This Sean Landers might take you hours to read. Sean's paintings are, that's a huge painting. I mean, that's a 12-foot to like 15-foot painting. So you could go and read all of like, the story that's in there. Or it could be an actual physical duration, a phenomenological time of how long it takes you to move around the gallery. And if you've been to Paris, to Monet's, to the L'Orangerie, as you move across, you are moving as in a film or a panorama or as a train going by a landscape. This work is animated by the viewer as they move through it. And I think the way that I think about it
is if you describe the difference between time-based art that we usually talk about, let's say film, and painting, which people don't talk about as time-based, the reason they make that distinction is based around the time of the object itself. They locate time with the object. This Hitchcock film is 2 hours and 45 minutes. That's the duration. This painting doesn't have any duration, so that's zero. But what if you locate duration with the viewer, not the object? So I sit in front of this Hitchcock watching it for 2 hours and 40 minutes. But I can sit and activate and walk around this Monet for 5 minutes. And if you locate duration with the viewer, painting is completely time-based. Certain paintings are very fast. That staccato rhythmic quality, they feel fast. And certain paintings feel incredibly slow to me. And that was basically to wrap towards a conclusion. That is, these are the ideas that really went into that show. And to some of the works that preceded it. As an example, this is a work I did called 24 Hour, or it's called Sky Clock Marfa. And I made this after going to Marfa. It's 8 paintings that depict one day, both suggesting that sort of animation and then compacting that time of the day into a series of works, really about what the color of time is. 3 o'clock in the afternoon. 6 o'clock in the evening, sort of dusk, and asking, like, what are our color experiences of times of day, or what are the emotional resonances of certain colors that they relate to time or experience? Early dawn. And in the show, to end where we began, what I really wanted was to play with those ideas of time between the two spaces. So the front room, I wanted to be very slow paintings that felt like taffy that was pulled. They take a long time to look at. There's not much in them. You have to move around the space. Your experience of the room and of the paintings is quite slow. Whereas the back room, the piece that's upstairs, operates like a compaction of time. 1 year is compacted into a single instant. All of those 365, you can experience a year, which takes so slow to move through, instantaneous. And to use it like a film metaphor, editing, fast editing the film, film that relies on kind of editing a bunch of clips together to make a holistic experience, is like the back room. A lot of frames aggregate to one experience. Whereas the front room is more like a deep focus film where the camera just stays on you, where you just, you know, a tracking shot, or Citizen Kane, where there's no editing, you just watch the characters move through this giant set. So the front room, really, I wanted the paintings to be slow, and the back room, I wanted it to be much quicker. And I think to really engage with this idea as painting as a, you know, as a, like I said, as a time-based or durational work. And both of those ideas, both about the idea of painting as a time-based work, as a contemporary work, and about the humanism, are ideas that I connect directly to Impressionism. And they're one of the thousand reasons that I think Impressionism is still very salient and relevant today. So we'll just move through two of these, and then if there are questions. These are sort of, actually, these are kind of the scale they are, actually. That's probably about right. So these kind of like Martin-like shapes on this one really, to me, create this slow, creamy space that we're in the front. Yeah. That is all.
Clap for you.
I can take a question or two, I think, before we wrap.
Yeah. Does
anyone have one? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yell it out.
Yeah. Your work, kind of like Magritte's, to me, is reminiscent of what Coleridge described as the meaning of poetry. That's to say, emotion recollected in tranquility. Do you think that's fair to say.
God, that's great. I'm going to use that from in my next talk. No, I think that's completely fair. I say to people all the time that, well, actually, I'll answer it this way. I work with Kara Walker, the artist, sometimes, and one of the things I admire about Kara is her work is really emotionally resonant. When you see the work, you feel something, and I really looked up to that in her work. And when I watched her work, I realized that that doesn't happen conceptually. You don't decide, I want to make my work make people sad or angry or funny. You realize that by existing in that state when you're making the work. And that when you are presently really like feeling what will be in the work, there's a way that you imprint that upon to the work and that that's transferred to the viewer. And I personally believe that if I don't care about it, why can I ask anyone else to care about it? And that if I'm in a state of full feeling, however difficult that is, that's the state I should be all the time. You know, emotion, and then re-experiencing, recollecting. I mean, that's sort of like the bread and butter of my practice. So yes.
Yeah, just follow up.
Yeah.
A little tiny bit. The context of that is that he was writing this at a time when there had been a transformation in poetry from the well-crafted Martinez-Sull work that was supposed to be mimetic and, you know, kind of a flawless replication of a perceived objective reality, etc., etc.
Sure.
Apropos of your discussion of Vermeer earlier, etc.
Sure.
To the Romantic movement in which the truth of things, or truthiness, if you want to invoke a modern whimsical expression, resided in your being able to accurately express and invoke the emotion that you as an artist perceive, perhaps as a medium, and somehow manage to provide your reader, or later on in painting, your viewer with a medium to perceive that, to feel that experience.
Totally. I don't mean I it's been fairly uncool in probably the 90s and post-90s to be a real feeler, and I'm still running into that. The only negative backlash that I got from the show was people who were very uncomfortable by how earnest it was. The piece is an earnest piece. There's no sarcasm. I'm serious about it. And it's a feely piece, and I cry when I look at painting and when I listen to music, and I'm a feeler, and that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable in the previous generation, and I kind of like that. I kind of like sticking the stick in there. Like, I'm going to cry in front of Matisse's piano lesson all day, and he won't stop me. So, yeah, totally. One more? Yeah.
When you were putting this piece together in your mind, did you consider the idea of using the space above as part of the...
You know, I did, and there's no reason it couldn't be hung like that. This piece does not have installation instructions. It's a different story, but I really like the idea of malleable manifestation. And one of the great things about a grid is that the piece allows itself to be hung in any number of ways. And that, I leave that up to the owner and the institution. I would love to see it as one long line, not in a grid, across like hundreds of feet. I would love to see it on a ceiling. I would love to see it on a single wall or in an entire room. I would love to see them really spread out. I think I leave those things up to the curator because they know the architecture of their space, or the owner who knows the experience they want to put in their home. And that's where you share creative control with the future, you know?
This may be too long an answer, I don't know, but I'm curious about the notion of representing something so vast in this small scale. Can you talk about the relationship of the subject and its vastness to the size of the object?
I think that's both. I think I wanted the room itself to be the vastness, the horizon, that the room, the whole piece, was the sky and looked like the sky, but made up of all the skies of the year. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of framing, like a Terrell of framing a piece of something, a moment. The way that we, in retrospect, think about our lives. If you think about the last year, and I asked you to pick any day, it would be only in memory. Is not in completeness. Memory is in very small pieces. And then to then create the experience of memory and of commemoration of looking back on that year, we would only remember the last year as fragmentary. So it would never be holistic. It would only be very small fragments that can be meaningful, each one.
Yeah. I just have a question. I notice it's all daytime sky pictures, and I'm wondering if you thought about doing nighttime. And of course, it would vary not only is the time of the night, but also which hemisphere you're taking them from.
Sure. And the answer is yes. And actually, the piece that I will next have up is not of the sky, but it is landscape, and it is day to night.
Oh, okay.
And so, yes, I've been thinking a lot about the night recently, and it will go up in May. So it's also painters love to paint nocturnes because you get a lot of purple out, and you're like... Which actually, you should go upstairs and check out the amazing painting show, because the crepuscular light of maroons and greens that go into twilight are really exciting. Really exciting. Well, thanks everybody for coming.
Thank you.